Welcome to The B-Side, a podcast that engages thinkers, mostly sociologists, at the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and much more. We're your hosts, Corey Fields and Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
Hello, hello.
Hey. So, as we do each week, the episode is introduced by one of our favorite B-Side recordings, and this week we have Mary J.
What?
Mary J. Blige's I Love You, which was occasionally the B-side track to You Bring Me Joy. Just a quick note, by the 90s, you know, releasing singles with an A-side and a B-side was kind of going the way of the dodo bird. So fortunate to have one of Mary's hits on there as a B-side recording.
That's nice. That's a classic. That's classic. Mm-hmm.
So joining us today are our guests, Irvin Malik R. Matthew from the University of Cincinnati and Abigail Sewell from Emory University. Malik Matthew is a native of the South Bronx in New York City, where his interest in understanding social inequality developed naturally as a result of the race and class disparities he saw around him in the poorest community in America. His work examines race and class inequality in educational and occupational outcomes, as well as broader theoretical questions about how social stratification processes operate in society. Abigail A. Sewell's work focuses on the political economy of racial health disparities, the social construction of racial healthcare disparities, and quantitative approaches for studying racial inequality and structural racism. She's the first author, most recently, of Living Under Surveillance, Gender, Psychological Distress, and Stop, Question, and Frisk Policing in New York City, published in Social Science and Medicine in 2016, where it was the lead article of the volume. Malik, Abigail, welcome.
Hello, hello. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, guys. Glad to have you on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I thought we usually go alphabetically by last name. So Malik, let's start by talking about your work. What are you up to?
Originally, I was spending a lot of time with just general questions about social inequality in education. But the University of Cincinnati in recent years has really been dealing with questions about how to bring diversity and inclusion to life on our campus. People may or may not be aware that we had a police officer-related shooting here a couple of years ago, and it really set off a lot of campus activism that was going on and shed light on the town-gown relations. And so I recently started pivoting toward just answering questions about how we engage the topic of doing diversity and inclusion on campuses. You know, everybody has it as the catchphrase, but when we aim to really make it something that benefits our students and the surrounding communities, that it turns out is much more complex than putting together a poster.
Yeah, I think it kind of brings to mind, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this a little bit more later, but it brings to mind the fact that, you know, academics seem to be really great at studying, quantifying, qualifying diversity or lack thereof in institutions and sectors outside of academia. But when it's time to turn the gaze on yourself, right? And, you know, particularly when we have to talk about thinking about your own discipline, you know, there seem to be blinders on.
Indeed.
So in terms of what you've done in terms of your research and your thinking about this, and actually in some ways the practical sort of lived experience of it on your campus, Malik, what do you see as like the real challenge to these issues of diversity and inclusion? I mean, I feel like there's often a lot of talk about pipeline stuff and, you know, things about like welcoming culture. But from your perspective and the work you've done, what do you see as like the real issue to tackle to improve diversity on college campuses and to improve, you know, feelings of inclusion? What's the problem here?
Well, there's a nice, simple question. But really, I think there are a couple of problems. The first problem is probably intuitive to academics, which is that people aren't really clear on exactly what the issue is. Administrations know that there's something wrong. Right? They can tell that there's something that needs to be resolved, but actually naming it, identifying it, figuring out where the disconnects are, that part is much more difficult. And then the second part is the question of who actually then does the work. And we know historically it's fallen to minority faculty members, often to tried to realize these diversity missions. They've asked the students to come forward with ideas for doing things, but it doesn't really seem like a full partnership. It seems like, okay, this is an issue that you guys have, therefore you guys provide us with solutions. We'll sign off on it or not. Mm-hmm. So that's really where I see a lot of the problems in higher education. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like it's a problem that the university community in general perceives as a general problem. Hmm. Pretty similar to society, right? We don't have male problems. We have societal problems, and then we have women's problems. We have societal problems, and then we have minority problems, right? The majority group is always perceived as the general, and the subordinated groups are often treated as kind of the sideshow situation.
Yeah. I mean, one interesting aspect of this, and the hearing you talk makes me think of this, and I've gone back and forth on this question, is the issue, will the solution be, it's like, is it a process problem or is it a values problem, right? And so the question is, well, can we institute a certain set of processes that'll elicit the outcomes we want around, you know, representation, or is this an issue of people just aren't actually into it? It's not something that people care about. There's a lot of rhetoric around diversity and inclusion in universities. But when the rubber hits the road, right, when it comes time to actually making it happen, people don't actually care. And so if you can change processes as much as you like, right? But if people don't actually care about it, if it's not a priority within institutions, nothing's going to happen. So in some ways, it's sort of interesting to think about this tension of, well, do you change hearts and minds or do you change application review practices? And in some ways, I feel like it sometimes varies by institutions. Having had exposure to different kinds of institutions, sometimes I think, oh, you know, this is a process problem. And other times I'm like, oh, this is a hearts and minds problem. And you can change processes all day, but, you know, they don't want to do anything about this. So nothing's going to get done. It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I'm not sure if there's like a set answer to this, but it's an interesting way to think about the problem. I think in some ways, yeah, I don't know. I feel like we've maybe erred on like process. It's like, well, if we institute the right processes, we'll get the desired outcomes. And to me, that seems like it suggests a lot of faith in the people executing processing.
It's kind of ironic. It looks like we're going back to some age-old questions in sociology around culture and structure. As a structural person, I'm going to tell you it's the process. Mm. But in reality, if you don't have a willing constituent, you can have many processes and they'll undermine those processes, even if they're very effective, right? So I do think we have a cultural problem. And I say that with all kinds of hesitancy around understanding the kind of what I would call the out that gives people in leadership. If it's a cultural problem, some people read it as a hearts and mind issue. Then one way to solve it is to get new people who have the right hearts and minds in those places.
Right. No, and I think in some ways, I think, you know, there is a way to think about this that totally acknowledges that it's a structural problem, right? And that, like, the situation doesn't occur because of what people believe or what's in people's hearts and minds necessarily, right? Like, it's sort of, but the fix to the structural problem actually might be well served by having the right people imbued with sort of discretion,
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I don't think of it as an either or proposition either, right? Yeah. I mean, if it is a structural problem, I believe there must be a concomitant culture that helps to undergird, right, the existence of that structure. So if you're just going to attack it as a structural problem, but you don't attack the culture, it's going to be ineffective. If you then decide, okay, let's just start the culture and then structure will change, good luck with that as well. I mean, I think that there needs to be this sort of two-pronged approach where you recognize the structural deficiencies or the structural roadblocks to actually trying to get to the end that you want, you know, in this case, diversity, however it is you define it, but also understanding that there needs to be a cultural shift, and whether that means people need to retire or whether that means Well, that means the provost needs to take out her big stick, right? And, you know, and start demanding that people at least fake the funk and pretend that there's been a deep cultural shift in order to help solidify those structural changes. That's what I think needs to happen.
Well, I mean, it's an interest conversion question, right? When we talk about interest conversion, we're talking about the ideology made manifest in structural changes. So it's key to build in the understanding that this interest benefits everybody. Now, mm-hmm. you know, throughout history, we've arrived at interest conversion through different ways. You know, sometimes by appealing to hearts and minds, sometimes by really threatening the viability of the structure so that it needs to bend so it doesn't break. But however we arrive at it, the interest convergence is the critical question, really. And so that's when I'm thinking about these questions, that's often what I'm thinking about. How do we find the point of convergence where it's not that the university feels like somebody asked you to do this and therefore mm-hmm. let's just do this token effort, but where it really comes to see the upliftment of the subordinated groups on campus and also the subordinated communities that often surround these universities as being integral to the university community itself.
I think that's totally right. Not that I'm the arbiter of all things right or wrong.
No, of course you are. Here on the B side, you are.
All right. Well, thank you, Malik, for sharing your new projects with us. What about you, Abigail? What are you up to?
Well, you know, trying to get tenure. Some of us have moved through that process and may not feel the stress of it as acutely. So yeah, like literally this is what I'm trying to do. Part of that is actually moving into the direction of policy from both the top down perspective as well as from the perspective of those who are proactively trying to bring about change from a place of being disempowered. And so I would say, you know, if I would think about the two of the more recent projects I'm working on, they have some kind of long-term trajectory. One focuses on how people who are ethno-racially marginalized, who are sexually marginalized, and who have had contact with the criminal justice system, either being formally criminalized or being surveilled by the system, what they do when they see police brutality and how they respond both as citizens as well as people who have a longer kind of life course and they're in with interest in their in a positive well-being. So that's a series of questions I've been fielding on national surveys, which have started to yield some convergence, suggesting a kind of a positive, at least health benefit to being proactive against police brutality, primarily through leveraging digital technologies, which is something that there's a lot of conversation around regarding, you know, armchair activism and so on and so forth. Well, in fact, digital technologies can actually be used to identify or provide a more realistic feature on the site of harm itself. And so we think about a number of folks who have been called, whose deaths have been called into the justice field. A lot of that is occurring because someone videotaped it. Someone recorded what actually happened. Or there was another version of the truth than the police. And then on the other hand, thinking about this, also, I guess, from the individual perspective, but not necessarily the individual who is proactive about going about justice, but thinking about it from the perspective of the legal intervention deaths and legal intervention assaults, but really basically looking at police data that is not actually recorded by police. So one of the short sites that we have within the policing research, surveillance studies and broad is that we really rely a lot on the data that police produce themselves. But we know, and anyone can tell you who's on the ground, who is dealing with communities that are affected by over-policing and aggressive policing policies, that the police records are not accurate and they're not even reliable. So we have to start thinking about other sources of data in order to understand the full effect of the carceral state on the human body.
Okay, just a short timeout. Somebody seems to be moving paper around or something because I can hear it being picked up by the mic. And so I'm not going to ask you not to do that. Just if you are doing it, if you could just mute your mic while you're doing it so that the mic doesn't pick it up.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so sorry to interrupt, Abigail.
Oh, no problem. That was my spiel. basically thinking about policy from the perspective of people who are actually engaging in strategies of resistance, as well as thinking about it from a data perspective of actually getting a better sense of how bad the problem is from other sources of data than we are typically reliant on within the criminal justice literature and the broader studies on surveillance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's actually an incredible, timely project to be working on. One of the questions that that brings up for me is I actually think that we've seen, even with the presence of what seems to be seemingly objective visual evidence, right, of what occurs during a police shooting, that we still see very few, if any, police who have shot unarmed people of color actually being charged or actually ending up being acquitted. And that brings to mind that saying, I think Groucho Marx is the first one, you know, who's credited with saying it, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes, right? So even in the age of this sort of digital visual evidence, it still seems to me that people find a way to interpret what they're seeing in certain ways. How do you get around that, Abigail?
So this is actually a really interesting question. I actually think the question, from what I know, mind you, if you were to go back 3 or 4 years, no one would say I would be doing work on police brutality. And therefore, you know, I'm not going to lie and say that this, what I do, is a function of the time that we're in. And part of that being the case is that I'm very attuned to police themselves, you know, how they see the problem. And I'm also very attuned to activists, people, police abolitionists, on how they see the problem. And what I find is that there, this question of how do you make sense of people lying to themselves about the issue at hand is actually a function of the question coming from a public that is not necessarily engaged the law from a legal perspective, right? So when we see someone get murdered on a video and we hear the shot go off and we see the body lose life, we know inside of our bodies, inside of our hearts and souls, that something is wrong, that it shouldn't have happened. And we can look back at other forms of the visualizations that are happening within that video and say, well, what caused this, right? The other part that we don't see is understanding how police are held accountable to the citizenry. So there's something called deadly force that is not the same as how public health folks and police abolitionists, for instance, think about force or the use of force or brutality. Deadly force simply means police is justified in using force to protect themselves and to protect other people, right? So even when there was a case that just came down like last week, and this guy got in a accident on I-95 north and in outside of Richmond, and he ends up getting out of a car, and he's naked and he's running around and he's clearly disturbed, and they tried to tase him and it didn't work. So they shot him and he died in the hospital. And people are looking around like, when was he a danger to anyone? He was unarmed and naked, right? But from a police's perspective, he was a danger because when they tried to get him to stop the first time, it didn't work. And so they then had to use deadly force. And when we go to the courts, there are cases, and there have been many cases, where these police have been called into the courts at some form of the process. Not always, they've been tried, whatever else, they've been called to account for their behaviors. They can usually say something that justifies the murder on the case of deadly force. that person was a danger to either the officer or themselves at some point of time, or they believed they were a danger to themselves or the officer. It doesn't actually have to happen. What I'm saying is that our laws are written so broadly to give police leverage to murder people in the name of criminal justice, right? So one of the things I back up and say is I'm actually not concerned about that. I'm actually concerned about the people who are affected by police brutality who are not written into the statistics. They're the ones that are not in the stops. They're the ones who are not in the death records. They're the ones who are not in the videos. And what we find by using this kind of collateral consequence view of police brutality is that the effect of over-policing and aggressive policing is far wider, far deadlier, in a sense, than what we see on paper. And now we have an issue that actually appears to be a constitutional issue. Because when you have a public policy that's designed to do one thing, but it does 10 other things that it's not supposed to do, now we have to call into question whether that public policy is actually in the interest of the public.
So, Abigail, I had a question. I guess more generally, partly because your work is so clearly aligned with praxis, right? And like sort of real implications in terms of policy and activism, but also, you know, it's incredibly rigorous scholarship, right? So one thing I was wondering, and I guess part of this is like, I have to imagine there are a bunch of groups and a bunch of, you know, activists, policy folks who are interested in your work and would love to have you on their team, so to speak, right? Like on their side. So I was wondering for you as a scholar, how do you go about deciding what type of groups you're going to work with, right? Because in some ways, it's not just about them choosing you, right? Like, it's also about you choosing them, because it's going to be a reflection of your work and your stuff. But there are like a lot, you probably have a lot of opportunities to get engaged with this at not just an intellectual or academic level. So I'm wondering for you as a scholar, how do you go about deciding who you want to hook up with and, you know, connect your work with?
I mean, you know, number one, I mean, my general answer is yes, when people ask me to do things.
Okay.
What you're asking, however, is there may be a time when you're not actually invested in saying yes. Mm-hmm. Because either, and we would presume, because such a group or person has explicit motives that are not in alignment with what you're interested in, or implicit, insidious motives and tactics that actually undermine your arguments. So I will tell you, you know, my number one ally, public health folks, people who are working in criminal justice system, who are interested in reform. There are a lot of people who understand that reform is necessary. So I'm very interested in people who want to have the conversation. Recently, I've begun to have conversations with people who are actually in law enforcement, who are interested in reducing bias in the way in which they apply the law. I think that's an interesting conversation. I mostly listen in that situation. But what I'm very clear about is I'm not interested in having a conversation with journalists because a lot of that is just sensationalism. I'm not interested in having a conversation. You know, I love, you know, other academics, but if we're not talking about how to use the knowledge to bring about changes in politics, policy, and praxis, then I find that to be a redundant conversation. If we're having a conversation about, you know, errors in how we measure things and differences in, you know, the data, like that to me is a conversation that's only as good as what you'll do with it, right? So I generally, again, I'm going to say yes. I really, really like working with folks who are in public health. I really, really like working with clinicians, with medical doctors, with nurses, with social workers, because they are actually on the ground with the people who are most affected by police brutality. Either they're the ones who are, you know, trying to figure out how people are going to cope and deal with the losses that come with incarceration process, or they're people who are really trying to think about how to reframe their approach to the body or to the healing process to account for all these ways that they know are coming into the encounter, but have really not been a part of formal kind of institutionalized process within the medical sciences and so on and so forth. So that's, I really like working with clinicians. And for me, I feel like that's really where policy starts. It's folks who have a, they have institutional goal to make things better.
Awesome.
Right?
Well, cool. That makes a lot of sense.
Okay. So thank you both. Thank you, Malik and Abigail, for sharing what you're up to in terms of your work and also your advocacy. I think now it's time for us to turn those sociological gazes onto something less academic, but no less sociological, as we do every episode. So Corey, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we have a bunch on deck. I figure we have a Georgian on the show. So given that it is the day after Stacey Abrams won the Democratic nomination for governor in Georgia, why don't we talk about that? So, yeah, I mean, I think for people who've been living under a rock, especially in the past 24 hours. Stacey Abrams is an African-American woman, attorney, author, businesswoman, who was House Minority Leader in the Georgia State House, and was running for the Democratic nomination to be the Democratic candidate for governor in Georgia. And she won.
Yeah, they were calling it the race between the two Stacys.
Right. So, yeah, so this is big news, right? Because it's also, you know, she is, you know, on track or on deck to potentially be the first African-American woman governor in these whole United States.
And she is already the first African-American woman to win a primary, right, for governor.
So we've already had a lot of greatness, but we're on the cusp of even more greatness. So I don't know. That seems like worth giving an old spin on the B side. Like I said, especially since we have someone who has been on the ground.
That's funny. So I will give you my Stacey Abrams, you know, she my cousin speech. So Abrams is not my cousin. However,
these all are cousins.
Exactly. She totally is my cousin. She went to school in DeKalb County, which is where I grew up, and she represents unincorporated DeKalb County, primarily parts that I grew up in. So Campbell Park, Cedar Grove, Columbia. I mean, these are the spots. This is basically South DeKalb, you know, and South DeKalb is a predominantly has historically been a predominantly Black area. There is essentially a dividing line in DeKalb County that starts around just south of Emory. If you're north of it, it's predominantly white and other populations. And if you're south of it, it's all black. So when I grew up in the area I grew up, there was one white person that could be counted in the Black group. And we're like, who is that person? So, you know, Stacey Abrams, you know, she comes from a very strong, I would say, community, cultural community, mm-hmm. political community, economic community of people who it's not like we ain't had stuff. We've had stuff. I mean, that part of DeKalb County, at least for Black folks, is more some of the more, you know, affluent parts of the area for Black people writ large for Atlanta. Okay. Then she goes to Spelman and she gets this interdisciplinary degree that includes a little sociology in it. So she is definitely well versed in this. And I think that a lot of people see themselves in her in Atlanta, in Georgia. But I think this thing is that she has an ability to talk across populations. She's able to talk in ways that people who should not be voting for her will vote for her. They would say, I would never have voted for someone like that until she opens her mouth and she starts talking and she tells you her credentials and she tells you where she's been and she tells you that she's going to bring back Georgia to its greatness. I'm being a little funny right there. But we have a problem in Georgia right now where the Republicans, essentially, they have really no, they have no one that really will challenge them, not politically. And not at the electoral level, because they cannot get enough consensus among Democrats for a person. Plus, on top of that, there's not a Democratic person who can pull in enough of those Republican votes and actually get themselves the majority of the state of Georgia vote. So she won, which is so amazing. She won at the state level, right? She's been working at the state level for a very long time. And she has a platform and a politic that can speak across political ideologies. I think it's very, and it doesn't mean that she is neutral or conservative. She's actually not. She's actually really, really progressive. So this progressive Black woman who's not really from Georgia, but who grew up in Georgia and who has all of the institutional affiliations that people in the South really respect, this person can call in all of those different identities and get people fired up against a Republican leadership that is really making a joke of themselves right now.
Well, I mean, for me, at least, like listening to her speak, you know, just to your point of her being a progressive, my understanding is she's like, you know what? I think I have a lot to work with in terms of the young folk, in terms of, you know, people of color in Georgia, right? So I don't need to be going out there and trying to court the white male conservative vote, right? And, you know, and if she wins, you know, and it, you know, she definitely has a shot. If she wins, like, she actually might be someone to be, the Democrats should be going to help rewrite their playbook.
Yeah.
You can certainly think about what she's up to as, you know, maybe providing a broader blueprint for progressive politics in the U.S., or certainly Democratic politics, right? Like, because it seems like what's compelling about her, I mean, it speaks to what Abigail was saying, is she connects with multiple audiences in ways that don't feel pandering, right? Like, it feels like she actually does have an economic message around sort of issues, you know, labor and workers, that would actually speak to, you know, a sizable contingent, you know, of this sort of mythical white working class that Democrats are, you know, now sort of beholden to courting. But she manages to do it in a way that doesn't feel like, you know, abandoning the, you know, sort of racially progressive politics, the gender progressive politics of the party. And it doesn't just feel cosmetic in that, like, oh, well, if you have a Black person sort of saying this corporatist neoliberal stuff, you know, you kind of get to check both boxes, right? Instead, it actually feels like, no, it's, you know, she is sort of embodying how you can be committed to, you know, a pan-identity kind of politics on the left, right? That speaks to multiple audiences in ways that, you know, make people feel heard and not just conglomerated into this lefty blob. So I don't know. I'm actually really excited about this race. I mean, I think, you know, already what she's achieved is amazing and definitely of note. And I think there are a lot of people who are going to be keeping an eye on it as it, you know, the race itself progresses. I mean, it seems like looking at the numbers and sort of looking at how things have gone, you know, electorally in Georgia, it's an uphill battle. It's definitely going to be a fight. She has a fight ahead of her, but I don't know. It doesn't, I mean, it looks like this is a winnable election in some ways, right?
Mm-hmm. So Malik, what are your thoughts?
Well, I've been kind of curious, because we have, of course, local primaries here in Cincinnati and politics, and I'm involved in paying attention to and interacting with the political scene. The question about what makes the ideal candidate has been topical here. She seems like a great candidate for where she's at. And I actually lean toward preferring people to be great candidates for where they are at, because they're aiming to represent people. Now, you know, when they get to D.C., of course, they sometimes move as a collective, but I really wish politics were more local, and that people really did look for candidates who fit the locale, as opposed to this is what we consider to be the ideal and we'll try to find this blueprint and place such a person in every community in the country that we can fit it in. That's my main thought is, you know, when people talk about purity tests and is this person progressive enough or things like that, you know, we're looking for candidates who fit the constituencies who they're supposed to be serving. And really that's the gap in our political system right now, is that our politicians don't fit the constituencies. They really just try to represent, I guess, the corporate interests, the party interests, very few of the local interests. So, you know, I'm glad to see different types of candidates pop up around the country, whether they fit a similar profile or not. You know, if it fits whatever is local to them, you know, that I think is the better strategy, as opposed to trying to find a political strategy that fits across the party.
Well, on that prescient note, Malik, I think we're gonna move on to our second banter topic, which I think is actually something that you were interested in talking about on this episode. So the hashtag MeTooPhD movement. Malik, you wanna introduce this?
So people are, I hope, pretty familiar with the Me Too movement in general now. Women are being more outspoken about experiencing sexual harassment, sexual assault, all forms of gender insubordination. And it's something that we've discussed as academics for a while. And so it's welcome to see it now making its way into public discourse. But also, one of the things that strikes me is that a lot of academics, to borrow a phrase from somebody who will remain unnamed, a lot of academics are woke on paper. Right? But when it comes to practice, when it comes to what we study being manifested in our own lives, we're either blind to it or we turn a blind eye to it. And in examining social inequality in general, it was easy for me to get a feel for racial subordination because I'm Black. It was easy for me to get a feel for socioeconomic subordination because I grew up in a poor community. But two areas that were blind spots were sexual orientation and inequality along gender lines. And in being involved with racial justice movements, we often notice that we call on people who are, particularly we call on white people, to say it's not enough to just be a good white person. It's not enough to just not aim to perpetuate inequality. You have to speak up. You have to enter the uncomfortable conversations. You have to engage when you have people who are in your circle who are involved in problematic behaviors. And so the Me Too PhD movement is something that strikes me as very meaningful in that way. An opportunity for us to really take a step back, look at the things that go on in our circles, it's not rare, and actually bring to life what we talk about, what we call on other people to do. I don't really have a clear idea of what we should be doing. Part of it is very disquieting to me personally, but I also think that because it hits me as something that's uncomfortable, that only lends to the credibility of thinking about it as an urgent matter, and one that maybe in working through, we also can help figure out some other problems as well.
Well, I think that Malik is picking up on something that is really crucial around how we deal with not just inequality, but how we deal with inequities. So one of the problems, I think, when we move forward on issues that appear to be affecting segments of the population, particularly disempowered segments of the population. And in fact, those populations are actually arguing that we're disempowered because these things are going on, right? We've been kept out of the loop. We haven't been given the benefit of the doubt. And when we try, people ask for us to pay a price that we actually can't actually bear. And even if we do bear that price, it's coming with these type of invisible clauses, these invisible, I would say cookie crumbs. And people are wondering why everything's so messy around us. And they haven't accepted the fact that we actually have a need that isn't being taken care of. So I think, you know, the biggest difference, I have had some administrators try to use the term inequity to talk about why everybody should get the same type of pay. I'm like, that's not the conversation about equity. That's a conversation about equality, right? You get equity is about what people need, right? You give them what they need in order for them to show up to the table in the same way. That's not giving giving everybody the same thing. And if you want to have a conversation about equity, we can have that conversation, but that's not the conversation we're having right now. And unfortunately, we have been mixing the conversations when it comes to issues of diversity. I think the Me Too movement is actually showing this for us. We've been talking about this issue as a bad apple. There's this person out there that's out there doing random stuff, but he's doing it, in a, or she is doing it in a way that is we don't approve, right? What are we going to do about that? Well, there is a generational aspect of this, okay? The Me Too movement, in some sense, is a reflection, in a lot of sense, is a reflection of the sexuality politics of the last 200, 300, 400, 500, I don't know how many thousands of years, right? So there's no reason for us to believe that it is really just one bad apple.
Right. And I mean, in some ways, it's hard to sort of sustain that kind of argument, right? That it's just, one-off bad things. And obviously, there's like sort of systemic problems with this. But I guess what's one of the things to think about I've been thinking about a lot in relation to this is like, you know, we talk about, it's sort of multi-level, right? And at what level can intervention happen? Because so often, especially if you think about this as like, you know, the discipline or like the profession, right? It's like, well, there are multiple layers here because it's like there's like individual institutions and what practices are they going to do? But then it's like, well, what are we as like a discipline going to do about this? And then there's also, you know, sort of like, what do you do as an individual professional when you hear about something, right? Like sort of what's your responsibility? And I do think, you know, and I guess kind of as a process question, one of the things that's going to have to get hammered out is how do these things operate at these different levels? And like, how are we, and so I know for me personally, I can think, well, when I hear about something, you know, that person is going to have to be canceled because like, that's not cool. And it's not consistent with my politics. It's not consistent with the kind of world I want to live in. And it's not consistent with what people should have to sort of go through to do their jobs. Right. But it's also like, but then, okay, well, how does that relate to the institutional policies of any given university? And then what does that have to do with what, you know, the ASA is going to do with this person or ABS or SSSP, right? And so I think, you know, what I hope in some ways is that we can push the conversation so that we're actually having to talk about that, right? Like, and sort of, you know, what does censure look like in these kind of contexts, right? And who issues censure? I don't know. It seems like it's kind of like one of these sort of things that, you know, has been at our doorstep, but now we're having to talk about.
I mean, one of the things that I've observed is that very often, you know, as I said earlier, I mean, academics are really good at talking the talk, but what about walking the walk? And, you know, we were also talking about structure and culture earlier. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen, you know, primarily when it comes to women, but, you know, sometimes, you know, I've seen it with men as well. You know, when there are instances of sexual harassment, sexual misconduct, or, you know, just straight up bullying, right? You know, based on your gender. You know, one of the ways that universities respond is they say, you know, well, you know, if you didn't levy a formal complaint, then it didn't happen.
Right.
Right. And in some ways I understand that. But for example, you know, if you are someone who is tenure track and coming up for tenure and understand that the first vote, the first hurdle you need to clear is your department. And if that harassment, misconduct, bullying, et cetera, is coming from, you know, a senior person in your department, what is levying such a complaint going to do? Especially since generally the first place you're meant to do that is at the ombuds office, right? The ombuds office, of course, being set up in order to mediate these kinds of situations. And I would say generally in the interest of the institution, not in the interest of the individual.
Mm. So you know what I find, it's a paradox. So you can't have a bad apple theory of why it happened, but then want a structural response. Mm-hmm. I think for me, this is where the disconnect is, because these institutions, all of the procedures that we have set up to deal with sexual violence in academia, at least, they're still based off of a bad apple logic. As in, well, let's find out whether in fact this thing happened, and in fact it is evidence of sexual violence or bad behavior that is not representative of being a professor. The recent accusations that have been made against Roland Fryer at Harvard, people are spinning their wheels trying to figure out how to make sense of what, not just what happened, because also how the university responded. The university is now being accused essentially by at least three women that when they went to the ombuds office and they made their complaint, that they basically were dismissed. Mm. And they were dismissed because this was, they're making the argument that they were dismissed because this was basically a protected star faculty. All right. So essentially this faculty had achieved a level of renownment in Harvard, a vaunted place by itself, where they could not be a bad apple,
right?
Even if they were a bad apple, right? And so we still have this very, what I would call individualistic logic to a structural problem. It's a structural problem. It wasn't just one person. It was a lab. People saw that. People didn't say anything about it when it was happening, and it kept going on, right? And there were people who dropped out of the program and went to another discipline and went and did other things because of all of that happened. I really would just like to push, you know, I don't think the answer, I do think we need to have more conversations about this, because without the conversations, we're going to stay stuck in this kind of, you know, oxymoronic place. But I also really want us to push the question about what type of justice do we want to bring to this equation? You know, we right now we are, you know, we are whack-a-moles. We're like, you know, we see the one pop up, we knock them back out. We say, you can't come to this conference. You can't participate in this profession. We're going to take away your editorialship. That was happening in political science with actually someone who is very in my collegial network in a very like immediate way. And they essentially was using a journal to bring their own innocence back into the limelight. That is inappropriate use of professional resources, but that's not the issue. The question becomes, it's still that person is the problem. Not realizing that person is an institution by themselves. Think about all the things they've been doing and building on for decades. It's not just that they did bad things, but now the institution is a bad place because they are the person that is leading that. And I think we really, 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 really have to have the conversation about what type of justice is going to move us forward into a place, not just where people are getting their voices out into the public, but also that we are literally changing the institutions that we are a part of.
Yeah. Well, and actually what you just said made me think, like, in some ways, a good way to think about this is, you know, we need to be lashing out at like individual harassers and assholes and rapists, mm-hmm. right? But we also need to be lashing out at the institutions that, you know, protect them. And so part of the punishment, I guess, but it seems like part of the reaction should be, right, when, you know, prestigious places or prestigious journals are getting caught up in these Me Too situations and letting their resources get deployed that way, there needs to be some punishment for those things too, right? Because otherwise it does turn into like, well, we got rid of the bad apple, so we're good. But if people are like, you know what? I'm going to stop sending my undergrads to Harvard. I'm going to stop sending my papers to whatever journal, then, you know, the consequences, I don't know. Maybe that might make a difference. But of course, the issue always becomes these institutions are such powerful gatekeepers that, you know, the capacity to say fuck them is limited. Malik?
Yeah, well, I think that part of the reason we shy away from answering some of these questions is precisely, as Abigail said, because we don't really know what justice looks like. Or we don't want to know what justice looks like, right? Once once you have information, you're responsible for knowing what to do with it or deciding what to do with it. And so we have this information available to us. How do we proceed to the next step? It's easy to sit back and be external to situations and say, well, that this is what should go on in those situations. When you're immediate to that, when it's immediate to your workplace or to your discipline, and you're asked to come up with solutions, especially when the actors are known to you, sometimes friends of yours or what have you, it's a lot more uncomfortable to address those situations. And so we try to fall back from it. What we do know about institutions is that the legitimacy of authority is it comes from others acknowledging it, right? So you jettison the bad apple sometimes begrudgingly because you feel like that restores the equilibrium, but it really doesn't, because the system itself churns out these types of outcomes. People talk about us living in the ivory tower. I don't know what the ivory tower is. I've never been to the ivory tower. I don't understand what the secret handshake is. Nobody tells me anything. You know, if y'all know, put a brother on.
Oh, so yet again, we are running over time because we always have fabulous guests and we never want to end our conversation. We did have one more item, and I'm going to make an executive decision and say, okay, everybody gets to make one comment about this last topic, because we'd like to try and end on a light note, the royal wedding, right? So I'm going to lead off. How did I feel about the royal wedding? So I didn't actually watch the royal wedding. I was telling Corey earlier today that last year I was at a wedding between a young woman of Chinese descent and a young man of Afro-Carib American descent. And before dinner, along with the fabulous wed bar, we had sushi and fried chicken, you know, as the ways to merge the two cultures. And I didn't know whether to be offended or delighted because it was delicious, right? But that's kind of how I felt about the commentary about what went down during this wedding. So with that, have at.
Okay, so, you know, I don't believe in marriage. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, really hurts a lot of people I date, because they're like, so what are we going to get married? I'm like...
They want to lock you down. They were like, I want to get Abigail locked in love, right? Only for me.
So I do think we can have this conversation about, you know, the general politics of marriage that is problematic and heteropatriarchal and races and classes, and also recognize that, you know, it was beautiful. It was, I actually cried. And I happened to wake up just at the time when they were exchanging vows, and Harry was wiping his little face because he had a tear coming down, and she was looking up with the beauty, and there were flowers, and her mama was crying, and all the peoples was doing all the great things. And I was like, they started the singing, and the black boy was doing his little violin thing. And I was like, hallelujah, this is awesome. And this is blood money. This is all blood money. And I recognized that the beauty that I saw was in fact a product of all of the things that are wrong with this world. And I still cried. That's my statement. I'm like, are those tears of beauty or tears of sadness? I don't know.
Conflicted. Corey, Malik?
Okay. I don't know. I guess, right. I've been very entertained and very excited to see Black Twitter loving it. And so, in that sense, I don't know. Anything I have to say, it's probably secondary to that, in that, you know, people can enjoy what they want to enjoy. And if you find something that gives you a little piece of pleasure in this crazy world, who am I to rain on it? But get your umbrellas out, because I don't know. I feel like it's kind of connected to how I felt about Black Panther, which I was like, yeah, this is awesome. And representation is hugely important. But I feel like the conversation is regressing to the point where, like, representation itself becomes the endpoint, and we stop asking questions about, you know, what kind of institutions are we being incorporated into and what's lost with incorporation. So the whole thing, I don't know, there was an element of like, Blackness was just this sort of commodified thing that the royal family has now like picked up as an effort to refurb its own image. And it's been successful, and but
like they wanted to pick it up. They were like, what is this creature talking about? So.
Kind of right. Although, I mean, I will say like, they seem kind of into it. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure she's going to be like the new star over there. I mean, I guess maybe it's like some elaborate long con to like infiltrate the British royalty by America. So go Meghan, representing.
Oh, and Malik, any last words?
Yeah, so I've gotten into a lot of discussions with people about the meaning of this marriage. You know, Reverend Sharpton jumped out there talking crazy about how this shows white supremacy is on its way out.
Lord.
You know, and so it brings to mind a very frequent conversation about what interracial relationships mean for group dynamics. Personally, I think that it's wrong to try to make them represent group dynamics and interpret them through a group dynamic lens. So interpersonally, people can get along well, people can find love with each other. And I'm all for that. I don't think that that becomes the path to group dynamics shifting such that society arrives at a more equal state. There's certainly a lot more work to be done. And that should still remain at the fore. Having said that, it's also important to recognize that the arguments from the other side are equally problematic, which is that because society is racially unequal, we should therefore become more tribal. The interracial relationships therefore become some form of tribal betrayal. I don't buy into that either. I think interpersonal relationships live in a sphere of their own, and that primarily, you know, we should acknowledge them as their individual entities, for better or worse, whether the relationship is a great relationship or not, but also recognize that the work of bettering society goes on, and that that work requires a lot more than just contact. Because going back to what we said earlier in the conversation about just people changing hearts and changing minds, the changing hearts and minds matters in terms of motivating people to then work to change structure. And so in some ways, the interpersonal relationships, particularly in marriages, may help that, but it's not a proxy for it, and it's not a solution. So I don't know what Sharpton was talking about. I don't know what he thought he was talking about, but you know, I'm not picking up what he put down.
Well,
that's as good a note as any.
I know. And a great note for what is the last episode of this season of the B-side, right? And so to everyone out there, once again, you've been listening to The B-Side, a sociology podcast on the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and materiality. Thanks to our guests, Blake Matthew from the University of Cincinnati's Department of Sociology and Abigail Sewell from Emory University's Department of Sociology. We'd also like to thank our young producers, Anika Chowdhury at Queens College, Vashti Williams from Georgetown University, and Dana Hankson from Hale Friedman World Academy High School in Philadelphia. The B-Side is part of the growing Sociocast podcasting empire, y'all. You can check out us and our sister programs at sociocast.org or on Twitter at
B-Side_podcast. So yeah, so definitely hit us up on Twitter if you want to keep the conversation going this summer. And if we're going to be back in the fall, so if you want to be on the show or know someone who will be great on the show, feel free to slide up in our DMs and let us know.
All right. We're your hosts,
Corey Fields
and Leslie Hankson, both from Georgetown. And to take us out, here's the A-side to I Love You, You Bring Me Joy. You Bring Me Joy. That's right. Take us out, Mary. See you all in the fall.
Happy summer.